Some 14 years ago, when Brother Benson was 14 years younger than now, he was already president of the Boise Stake of the Church and was representing the Extension Division of the University of Idaho in his work in agricultural economics. He was at that time invited to come to Washington by one of the national farm organizations who wanted to interview him to see whether they wanted to invite him to become head of that organization. He met with a very distinguished board of directors, answered all their questions, at the conclusion of which they asked him if he would consent or consider being head of their organization in the city of Washington. His reply was that since they wanted him to deal with Congress, that he doubted very much whether he would be interested because, as he understood it, most of the entertaining of congressmen and senators was done around or in situations where cocktails and other drinks were evident, and he wasn't interested in any job that required any of the adornments of that kind. The chairman of the board of directors, who was a very distinguished jurist from Pennsylvania, immediately said, "Mr. Benson, we know about your background. We know about your religious beliefs. What's even more important, we know that you live those religious beliefs. And that's why we're interested in you. We don't want you to conduct your relations with Congress in the manner in which they're generally conducted by others. Will you come under the condition that you can live your life just as you want it and that you will elevate the morals of this organization?" And under those circumstances, Brother Benson came to Washington, then later became president of the Washington Stake. It was my great honor to serve as a counselor under him. From there, he became a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. We're delighted that he's with us today. He's not only a supporter by what he says, but by the fact that his entire family have been students here. I give you at this time Elder Ezra Taft Benson of the Quorum of the Twelve.
President Wilkinson, members of the faculty, students and friends of Brigham Young University, my brothers and sisters, this is an inspiring sight and a great opportunity and a great challenge and a humbling experience. I think I have made one decision since I left Salt Lake. I'm going to either move north or south of the city in which I live. Last night, Sister Benson and I left for Brigham City for a speaking engagement in one of the worst snow and rainstorms we've had, only to find when we got up the other side of Ogden that the roads were dry and the storm had ceased. Today, I left Salt Lake in a vigorous rainstorm, only to find when I got into Utah Valley, the roads were almost dry and the rain had ceased. So it's either north or south. Now I realize that you've come here today, possibly somewhat reluctantly. I guess many of you are wondering why you have to come. Sort of a perpetual thing, week after week, when there's so many interesting things to do outside. I read an ad the other day of a cleaning establishment, the Perpetual Cleaners. We clean anything 10 years in one spot. Well, many of you have been coming here not for 10 years, but for 52 weeks, probably out of 4 years. We have living on our block in Salt Lake a fine physician, a good Latter-day Saint, a real neighbor. I called his home some time ago, and his little 5-year-old girl answered the telephone. And I said, "Where's your daddy?" She said, "He's out on an eternity case." Well, this is sort of an eternal thing, this coming to assemblies and devotionals. When President Wilkinson invited me some weeks ago and sent me a list of suggestive dates, I took the one furthest away, thinking probably I'd be less busy then and have more time to think about it, only to find that it didn't work out that way. I was pleased to hear him announce that the faculty are going out to conferences again. I want to tell you about one faculty member without identifying him. It was his first visit to a state conference under this new arrangement. And he wasn't called on to speak in the morning session, but of course he knew he would be in the afternoon session. And when he came to the home of the counselor of the state presidency for lunch, he didn't have much appetite. He was worried about his talk. And they passed him the meat and he said, "No, thank you." Passed him the potatoes, "No, thank you." He nibbled at his salad and took a little fruit juice. And the good woman who'd prepared the meal felt rather sorry for him. He was so worried. Well, they went to the afternoon session of conference. The good sister who'd prepared the meal couldn't go because of a young baby and duties at home, but her children went. And when they returned, she asked her 16-year-old gangling son how brother so-and-so got along with his talk. And he said, "Well, Ma, he just as well a et." And I presume I just as well have accepted the first date that Brother Wilkinson suggested, rather than waiting until the last. But I am grateful to be here, and I wish to congratulate you, my brothers and sisters, on many things. I congratulate you on this wonderful chorus. I was so proud of them at the last general conference, up there representing this great institution. It's good to hear them again this morning. I congratulate you on the fact that you're here at Brigham Young University. You're fortunate to be here. I congratulate you that you live in this day and age of the world when there's such glorious opportunities and so much to be grateful for. I congratulate you on the fact that you've been born under the covenant, most of you, into good Latter-day Saint homes, in this day when the gospel is upon the earth in its fullness. I think the choicest time in all the world to live. And you're not just ordinary young people. I hope you'll never forget that. You're not just the run of the mill. You're not just average boys and girls, young men and young women. The very fact that you have been born under the covenant, the very fact that in my humble judgment, many of you have been held back in the spirit world to come forth in this day when the gospel is upon the earth in its fullness. You're choice spirits, and you have a great mission. And I have confidence that you'll fill that mission honorably. Youth of a noble birthright. A few days ago, I visited that queenly, lovely, elderly lady, Sister Ruth May Fox. 98 years of age and still youthful. She wrote those lines, "O youth of a noble birthright, carry on, carry on, carry on." And you will carry on. You're not here by chance, and you're not sent here by a kind father to fail. You're sent here to succeed. And with God's help and a close adherence to the standards which He has outlined, you will succeed in your chosen fields, be they whatever they may be. And this church of which you are a part and all of its institutions have a great future. I presume many of you thrilled as I did at the last general conference when the president of the church gave certain figures and statistics indicating the growth and the outlook for the church. I think it was never more favorable than now. The outlook for this great church organization and its institutions, including Brigham Young University. 350 new buildings have been dedicated since the end of the war. President McKay reported that there were 392 under construction. And there's more than that today because in the expenditures committee only last Tuesday we approved others. And as we sit here this morning, that same committee is approving additional buildings. The church is growing in its physical plant. It's growing in its standards of efficiency, in its performance. The faith of our people is increasing. There's ample evidence of that fact. We have over 10,000 missionaries serving in the stakes and missions. And I look hopefully forward to the time when that number will be doubled. And many of you sitting here this morning will have the opportunity to participate in that great responsibility. The stakes are multiplying. Within the next few days, you'll hear of stakes in other parts of the country, in states where there have never been stakes before. The church is growing. In the last 14 years, as some of you may have noted, our membership has practically doubled. But even more important, I think, than that, the evidence of our spirituality increase has shown even greater gains. Fast offerings have increased 230%, tithes 653%, and the end is not yet. And so the work is going forward. The outlook is most favorable and encouraging. And I feel that we're all fortunate to be associated with this great work. And we have faith in the youth of Zion. We have faith that you, my brethren and sisters, will measure up in your responsibility when the time comes to step into positions of leadership. As bishops of wards, presidents of stakes, members of high councils, mission presidents, members of the general authorities, in whatever capacity you're called upon to serve, you'll not fail. We have that confidence in the youth of Israel. And I believe most of you here today, yea, all of you practically, want to do what's right. You want to make your contribution. You want to live worthy of the blessings of the Lord. I know we're living in a world today where many of the principles and ideals of this people are being challenged. Challenged by a faithless materialism. You heard President McKay in his keynote address at the conference emphasize some of these facts. But people even in America, many of them, Christian people, so-called, seem uncertain of their position. No longer are they certain of what they stand for, what they believe in. Their faith has been weakened. Many cases destroyed by a godless, faithless materialism. It has become popular in many places to sneer at some of our American traditions, our way of life, things that are sacred, things that are important. Many people, even in this nation and other Christian nations, look upon morality and purity of life as being old-fashioned, outmoded, out of date. I took from my files this morning a little item clipped from your school paper many years ago, yellow with age, on this question of purity of life, having to do with stories. It's entitled, "It's a Poor Joke." When some woman blushes with embarrassment, when some heart carries away an ache, When something sacred is made to appear common, when a man's weakness provides the cause for laughter, when profanity is required to make it funny, when a little child is brought to tears, when everyone can't join in the laughter. Yes, there's a tendency to abandon many of the ideals regarding home and family and the sacred relationship in the marriage covenant. But the youth of Israel, members of this student body, I have confidence will ever hold these ideals and standards high. It's becoming uncommon for people in America to have devotion in their own homes with their own families. Family prayer, once common in America, has become very uncommon. Then what must we do as members of the church, young Latter-day Saints, the leaders, the strength of the church of tomorrow? I was impressed with the quotation which President McKay made during conference of the words of Paul to Timothy when he said, "I charge thee therefore before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall judge the quick and the dead at his appearing and his kingdom, preach the word. Be instant in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lust shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. And they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned into fables." The youth of this church will not be turned away from the truth. I hope that everyone within the sound of my voice will keep close to their hearts their faith in God, their belief in the divine mission of the Master, their testimonies that Joseph Smith is a prophet of God, the sacredness of the individual, the fact that the whole purpose of life, the whole purpose of the plan which the Lord has provided is to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. I hope that we'll continue our faith in the government of this great land, in the sacredness of family ties, and in all those things that have been so precious and dear to our forefathers. I hope we'll be true to our heritage and grateful for our blessings. I hope that we'll be honest in our dealings, loyal to our leadership, true to those standards which have helped to build this great church and this great nation. I hope we know that we're all immortal souls and that this life is only one chapter in the great eternities that face us. I hope we'll dare to continue to be a peculiar people. The Apostle Peter, when writing to the saints anciently, said this, "But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, an holy nation, a peculiar people." And so we are a peculiar people. And I have a feeling that as time passes, we'll become increasingly peculiar in many respects. Many people have referred to our peculiarities as a people. The very spirit you find here in this meeting and on this campus is one of the distinctive things about our people. And our friends who come from the outside are impressed with it. You heard President McKay announce at the last conference that there were 11 somewhat distinguished Danish visitors there at the morning session on Sunday. And one of the things that impressed them most was the spirit of that great conference and the spirit of the people here in the valleys of the mountains. I remember some time ago one of my friends from the east came out here to address a dairy meeting in Salt Lake. He'd been here before, but after that meeting, while visiting in my home, and he was quite a distinguished man. He said, "There's one thing that puzzles me about you people out here in the mountains." He said, "Every time I attend a meeting with your people, I feel a different spirit than I feel anywhere else. And I have attended meetings in every state in the Union." He said, "I can't describe it, but the best thing I can say is this, that I get a spiritual uplift every time I come among your people." I've told of the instance of a man back in the East whom I invited to attend one of our sacrament meetings. And after some weeks had passed, he did attend. And when I saw him a day or two later and asked him how he enjoyed the meeting, he said it was wonderful, especially the Spirit. But he said, "I wish you'd tell me why it is when your people come to the end of a meeting, they seem to have no place to go." He said that group of people after the benediction stood up, and then they just stood there and visited and visited. I thought I would never get out of that building. Well, that's part of this spirit, one of our peculiarities, this spirit of brotherhood and fellowship, which is very real. We're peculiar in the manner in which we build our physical plant, our buildings. Some of my friends have been amazed outside the church to find that the church never dedicates a building until it's paid for. Thing unheard of. When I was sent by the first presidency some 3 or 4 years ago to go back east and try and locate a headquarters to house the Eastern States Mission, President Smith said as I was leaving, "Now, Brother Benson, we'd like something nice. I'd prefer something on Fifth Avenue if we could get it." And I said, "President Smith, you don't want much, do you? I presume you'd want it across from Central Park on Fifth Avenue." He said, "Yes, that'd be just right. There isn't anything too good for the Latter-day Saints if we can pay for it." And that's it, if we can pay for it. Well, we got the headquarters on Fifth Avenue and right across from Central Park, and we paid for it. But in the conversation with that real estate man and the bankers involved, when we came to the time when we were to sign a contract, as they proposed, they were utterly amazed when they were told that the church would be paid for, that there would be no contract extending over a period of 30 or 40 years. And then this real estate man said, "My, you Latter-day Saints are certainly peculiar." And then he pointed to churches on that great street that could be purchased for 40 and 50 cents on the dollar because of the heavy debt load, and told of people, prominent members of the parish, moving out into another parish to get out from under the debt load. And our people point with pride to the fact that they've helped to build 3 or 4 different buildings as they've moved from ward to ward. And so we're peculiar. We're peculiar in our system of financing. The old law of the tithe, our fast offerings. Yes, the world has tried it. Some of my non-Mormon Christian friends, wonderful gentlemen, some of the ministers in other churches, marvel at this peculiarity of our people. And they'll ask, "How do you get your people to pay tithing?" Some of them even go so far as to say, "We've tried it, but our people don't respond." Simple, effective, one of our peculiarities. Another, the fact that we have no paid ministry. The fact that the ministry of the church is diffused and spread out throughout the entire membership. Not a body of organized listeners, but a body of organized workers. Every man, woman, and child practically having the opportunity to work, to serve, to perform, to serve in positions of leadership. No, we don't seek office. We don't resist release when it comes. Sometimes we welcome it. Neither do we resign from office. But we do respond to calls. And we have opportunity to serve. No paid ministry. Because the God of heaven knows that men and women grow best and most effectively through responsibility, through service, through the opportunity to work. And one of the marvels to the people of the world is the voluntary service which we get from the membership of the church. President Wilkinson may recall this incident that happened back in Washington. A group of Christian ministers asked permission to come up to our Washington chapel one day, and as they said, learn more about the Mormon Church in action. Of course, we were happy to have them come, and we asked our state missionaries to receive them and entertain them, which they did. This group of ministers were shown through the building, its uses explained to them. They listened to a lovely organ recital. They were served light refreshments. Then they went down into the Relief Society room to sit around informally and ask questions of this group of missionaries. Young men and women in school, working, but giving part of their time to the service of the church. And I remember slipping in at the door after they'd got into the Relief Society room and were sitting there asking questions. And I was impressed that there was one thing particularly that was bothering this group of Christian leaders. They kept coming back to the question over and over again in a little different way. And what do you suppose was worrying them? They couldn't understand how we're able to get so much voluntary service from the membership of the church. And as one of them said, especially the men. And then they pointed to our men who serve as bishops, stake presidents. They pointed to these young men serving as part-time missionaries. And they said, how do you get them to serve? And then one of them said, our people come to church pretty well. They'll be out to hear the sermon. And the following week, they'll be out for more possibly. But when we ask them to take some responsibility, they seem to fade away into thin air, especially the men. Voluntary service. I say to you, my brethren and sisters, there isn't anything like it in the world. I stood on the shores of war-torn Europe at the end of the war and saw a group of men come back to preside over those missions. As I tried to analyze the situation, I thought to myself, where could you find anything like it? Here a man who sold his grocery business to come back into Norway on his third mission to preside over that war-torn country. Here another man who left his chair at the university to come and preside in France. Another who turned over his furniture business in Salt Lake City to hired help to come over to war-torn Holland. And so we might go on. Voluntary service, one of our great peculiarities. It's almost an unheard-of thing to have a man or a woman refuse to serve. With that spirit, that willingness to serve, surely the work in which we're engaged has a great future. Our recreational activities is one of our peculiarities. I was down in California recently. We were planning on building a new church in a certain area, and there was a new Methodist church going up there. And I engaged in conversation with a man in charge, and he said, this is probably the first one of our churches ever to be built with a chapel and recreation hall in the same building. And then he told what the history had been. And then he told how he'd watched the young people in the Mormon church in their activities, their spiritualized recreation, in the dance, in music, in speech. And how the young people from his own church had been affiliating with them because of the recreational program. I have here the report from Brother Marvin Ashton on our recent MN basketball tournament. I wish there was time to refer to it. To show what was accomplished, the more than 970 teams that took part, how young people outside the church were attracted and came in and took part, and the converts that resulted, not only of young men, but their fathers and mothers. One of them, a Christian minister, who at first objected to his son taking part in our activities. Yes, we're peculiar as a people in our great recreational program for youth. We're peculiar, too, in our code of health, our word of wisdom. And on that point, I feel confident if present trends continue, we'll become increasingly peculiar. Because it's becoming increasingly peculiar to find young men and women who do not use tobacco and liquor and cocktails. In America today, there are 60 million smokers. 400 billion cigarettes consumed annually. 800,000 new smokers added to the rolls every year. 2 out of every 3 men are habitual smokers. 2 out of every 5 women. 1 out of every 7 boys 14 years of age. We're spending twice as much as we do for all the school teachers' salaries in America on this one item alone of tobacco. 96% of the families in America serve coffee daily. 8 in 10 adults are habitual users. 1 in 4 children. We've increased the consumption 50% in the last 10 years. Say nothing about cocktails. The Lord said something in that revelation about evils and designs of conspiring men. I presume there was never greater evidence of the activity of these men than there is today on the radio, in the press, on television. Some of the appeal so real. One of my kiddies said the other day, you can almost smell the tobacco smoke. Well, we're peculiar. I hope we'll stay peculiar as young people, that we'll have the courage to resist these temptations, these appeals of evil and designing men. Some years ago, Dr. Frank Crane used to write a column each Saturday. It appeared in some of our papers here in the West. And later he wrote a little book, I wish it were in print today, entitled, If I Were 21. And in that little book he sets down some of his positive conclusions after living a full life. Some of the things he would do if he were a young man or a young woman, 21 years of age. I read only a couple of paragraphs on this matter of living clean lives. He said, if I were 21, I would take no stimulant of any kind whatsoever. Whatever whips up the body to excess destroys the efficiency of the organism. Hence, I would not touch alcoholic drinks in any form. If one never begins with alcohol, he can find much more physical pleasure and power without it. The day of alcohol is past with intelligent people. Science has condemned it as a food. Business has banned it. It remains only the folly of the weak and the fatuous. If I were 21, I would drink no tea or coffee, as these are stimulants and not foods. Neither would I use tobacco. The healthy human body will furnish more of the joy of life if it is not abused than can be given by any of the artificial tonics which the ignorance and weakness of men have discovered. All this I would do if I were 21. Yes, we're peculiar as a people. We're peculiar in the fact that most of the men here today hold the holy priesthood, the authority to act in the name of God, the greatest power in this world, and the greatest blessing that can come to any man is to have a testimony of this work and to possess the priesthood of God. There isn't anything to compare with it. The honors of men, the wealth of the world, are as nothing by comparison. And yet this great power and blessing is conferred upon boys, young men, throughout the church and kingdom of God. We're peculiar in our standards of moral purity. The fact that it is our belief as a church that it is not necessary for young men to sow their wild oats, to tamper with evil in order to know that sin brings sorrow. There's no double standard of virtue in the church. The God of heaven expects the members of His kingdom, both men and women, to come to the marriage altar clean and pure. That's a rather peculiar thing in the world today, but it's part of our code of living, revealed from heaven above, and it will never change with the approval of the Almighty. We're peculiar in the fact that we have individual testimonies of the truth of this work. We're not dependent upon others. We may know for ourselves that this work is true. We may have a personal, individual, burning conviction which brings to us peace of mind, a feeling of security, a feeling of confidence in the future. Yes, these and many others are our peculiarities. We've said very little about doctrine, our belief in continuous revelation, our idea of God, the Book of Mormon, the eternity of the marriage covenant, our belief regarding universal salvation, temple work for the living and the dead. All of these are among our peculiarities as a people. God help us, my brethren and sisters, while living in the world, not to be of the world, to continue to be peculiar. I say to you that the world is willing to pay for the services of young men and women who live this peculiar way. And if you're thinking only of getting ahead in the world financially, in your chosen field or profession, then I say to you one of the greatest assurances of success is to continue to be peculiar, to live the standards and ideals of Mormonism. God help us all so to do that we may have no regrets. Because, my young brethren and sisters, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood and holy nation, a peculiar people. God bless us all in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.